we just managed to look at this self-scalability benefit of peer-to-peer architecture over the traditional client-server architecture. So we looked at a quantitative example, and sort of we saw that peer-to-peer applications scale better because you have peers assisting the servers in distributing a file. Okay. What we're going to do today is we'll look at a real application based for file distribution that is used by a lot of users, including possibly many of you. It's called BitTorrent. Even if you're not using it, it probably is something that is quite familiar. The idea behind BitTorrent is to share files. And just to get, my focus is not to go into a whole lot of detail in terms of how the protocol is developed and so forth, but just to give you a high-level idea of how the peer-to-peer aspect comes into play, and also some of the main ideas of the BitTorrent system. Okay. So the BitTorrent system, to start with, it has what is called a torrent. So before that, let's sort of start with the file itself. The file that you want to distribute, it's seen as a composition of several chunks put together. Okay, the chunk is the unit that you deal with in BitTorrent context, and a bunch of chunks put together form a file. And the set of peers who are engaged in distributing that particular file are referred to as a torrent. Okay. And you also have an entity called a tracker who is responsible for tracking various active peers in the system. Okay. So since peers can come and go, you want someone to be able to track who is in at a given point in time. So an incoming peer can query the tracker to determine who is already in. And file distribution happens by this trading chunks. So we'll see that in a minute in terms of how that works. But basically, this is the terminology used in BitTorrent context. Yeah, this, I've already gone through that. So one thing that I didn't mention here is whenever a new peer joins the system, it contacts the tracker, and it, in return, the tracker provides a list of peers, not the whole list, but a subset of the peers that are already active. And what the new peer does is to establish TCP connections to this the set of peers provided by the tracker. And they are effectively neighbors for the new peer. Okay. Neighbors here should be seen at a application level, not at the physical level. Okay. Each of these neighbors, even though they may have a TCP pipe between themselves, they actually may be multiple hops away, up to tens of hops away. That is possible. So essentially, we are trying to look at neighbor relationship at a very high level of abstraction, okay? Not at the physical level. So in terms of distributing files, there are two things. One is you try to pull chunks, and you try to send chunks. And you have to be sending chunks in order for you to be able to get any chunks at all. So that's the idea. So in order to pull chunks, the criterion that is used is to determine which of the chunks that you're looking for are rarest among your neighbors. So if a particular chunk is present in very few of the neighbors, then you look for that first. And then you go in that order. You might place a request for that chunk to that particular neighbor, but that neighbor may not give you anything in return if you are not among the top four for that particular neighbor. the top four is in terms of peers who are sending to that neighbor at the highest rate. Okay, so that is this criteria. So in order for a peer to send chunks to other peers, it needs to get data at a very high rate from those set of peers. If you are not in that top four, then all hope is not lost. You could get lucky, and that is the random element here, where from time to time, a peer tries to pick another peer randomly, regardless of whether that peer is sending to you or not, and starts sending chunks. Okay, so this is to increase the possibility of you getting new information. Otherwise, you can get stuck in a state where pretty much you don't have exchanges with peers who have remaining chunks of a file or new files. Okay. So let's see how this randomization works. So basically, the other part in terms of the deterministic part is fairly clear, that you try to always exchange files with whoever is supplying you the most data. Okay, so that way it's sort of a reciprocal relationship. So in terms of this randomized strategy, so imagine that you have a system where you have Alice and Bob, where each of them have their top four peers with whom they're exchanging their chunks. Now, randomly, Alice picks Bob and starts sending chunks. And this is referred to as unchoking in BitTorrent terms. Okay, so as if Bob is choked with respect to Alice at a given point in time, and then you're trying to unchoke. And in response, Bob's top four could be updated with Alice in that list, okay? Because Alice is sending data to Bob, and it could get into the top four data senders. And once that happens, Bob starts sending chunks back to Alice. So in a way, one of the peers that might be among the top four will disappear and make way for Alice. And similarly, the same thing would happen to Alice with Bob as one of the top four of its uploaders. So this way, your graph in terms of who is sending to whom keeps changing in a way to help you discover more information and fast in a fast way, because you could potentially depend on these relationships to give you files in a percolated form, but this helps in trying to do the file distribution in a much faster way. So that's about BitTorrent. That's all I have to say about BitTorrent. So essentially, you have these peers who are pretty much, they don't have any server as such. You have a tracker that's responsible for tracking who is present in the system at a given point in time. But beyond that, everything is done by peers themselves. Okay. The next thing that we're going to look at is what is called a distributed hash table. It's essentially a distributed database. Similar to the DNS system that we've seen last time, the difference here is you could store arbitrary information as opposed to a structured information like host name to IP address mappings. Okay, so here you could have something like the location of a particular file in the peer-to-peer system, or you could have the user location in Skype. So you want to find out where a particular Skype client is attached from, or a Skype user is attached from, and that keeps changing from time to time depending on the time of the day and what the particular user is doing. And you need some way to track it, and a scalable way to track it when you have millions of users is a distributed database like the DHT. Okay, so the idea here essentially is you derive a key and derive a key from the item that you want to actually store, and it has a corresponding value. Value is not so important here. So basically, the thing that you query with is what you care most. The response in terms of what it is mapped to is not so relevant. Okay, it is important when you're a user and you're trying to use this DHT system, but a design standpoint, the key thing is the key aspect. So you have a key value pairs that form the database, which are these pairs are distributed at different peers in the system. Now, the way DHT works is it tries to have peers given identifiers, which are integers, which are in the same space as your keys. Okay, so that's the key idea. So if you have 100 hosts, which are part of this distributed hash table system, then you could store values or keys in the range of 1 to 100. So essentially, there is a mapping between what you want to store and the identity of the peers in the system. So let's look at that a bit more. So the way you do it is you try and first give an identifier to each peer by this sort of in this range, where n is the maximum number of bits that you want to provide for the identifier, and then you have 0 to 2 to the power of n minus 1 is the possible set of peer identifiers you have. And you may have a key which which is not an integer to start with, but then you want to map it to the same space, okay, same range. And in order to do that, you apply a hash function, okay? So when you do a hash function, you can compress this into this particular range. And essentially, hash functions are for getting many-to-one mappings. And many-to-one mappings with one important property, where the possibility or the probability of conflict, where two data values mapping to the same point or getting the same hash value, is quite low. So therefore, there is no loss of information as such when you try to apply a hash function. So basically, you apply a hash function and they get a key which is in the same range as the peer identifier space, and then the storage comes in. So basically, you want to place these mappings in a distributed form at different peers. Now you have to identify, given a key, which peer you want to store that particular key value pair at. And in order to do that, you apply a simple rule, which is basically you try to go to the closest peer to the value of the key, okay? And basically, the remainder of the DHT system is just how you do this in a scalable way. So far, we didn't talk about the scalability as such. So this potentially could be implemented in a form where everything is in one host, and you're just applying this rule where you're trying to store it alongside a particular peer. So all the peers are basically logical or virtual. Okay, but the scalability comes from the fact that so there are two aspects to scalability. Let me slow down a little and then give you a flavor of what's happening here. So if you apply this rule of the closest peer, which has the closest peer to the key value, then you might have a value like 13, okay? You want to put this in the system, so then you would go and so find that, depending on how you apply this rule, you could either store this at 15 or 12. Let's suppose that we store it at 15, which is the successor to the key value. And similarly, if you have, let's say, 16, a value of 16, then pretty much you what that boils down is you apply this modular operation and then put it at 1, and so forth. Okay, so that's the circular part of the DHT idea. Now, if you think about what each peer needs to keep track of in the system, it just needs to know who the successor and the predecessor are. Okay, so if it knows that basic information, then it can pass the key to the right place around this ring or the circle. Okay, so if you think about how long it would take to resolve a query, so suppose now I stored 15, the value 13 at 15, and I want to search for that starting from, let's say, 1. Okay. Now, the way this circular DHT is organized, you traverse this in only one direction. And in this case, you have to traverse the whole circle to be able to get to 15, which is not very scalable because, you have n peers here and you're doing n searches. Okay, so to make it scalable, what we introduce is something called a, this is basically what is alluding to. Okay, so what you introduce is something called a shortcut. Okay, so you have shortcuts between these peer relationships which reduce the number of searches you have to do on an average for any given query. And it is possible to construct this sort of a system such that you increase the number of neighbors that you keep track of. So previously, it was just the predecessor and the successor. Now, you increase it to log n neighbors, where n is the number of peers, and you get a benefit in terms of query time, which is reduced to big O of log n as opposed to big O of n previously. So whenever you have a log term, probably if you have taken an algorithm's course, it is much more scalable compared to n or n squared or anything of that sort. So in a way, that's how a DHT system is scalable for storing information in a distributed form. Okay, compared to other forms of storing data. If you have a centralized database, clearly it is not scalable, it is a single point of failure and so forth. So compared to a centralized database, this is clearly scalable. Okay. Let's ignore all that. So another issue that you face when you have a DHT system is essentially when peers come and go. You have to maintain this structure. And in order to do that, you need to keep track of some information. So in the case where you don't have shortcuts, it's fairly easy. So you just try to keep your two immediate successors, okay, the next one and the one following that. And then whenever a peer leaves, you try and update that information in terms of who your next two successors are. And the same thing, you do the same thing for peer joins as well. You try and update your successor relationships, okay, successor and predecessor relationships. Okay, so that's the thing, and it's a bit more involved when you have a shortcut scenario where you have to update many more entries. So what we have seen so far is how you distribute files in a peer-to-peer system, and how you store information in a peer-to-peer system. Now, the next thing we're going to look at is the Skype example. Of course, I assume that most of you are Skype users. So it is inherently peer-to-peer because you have an entity A talking to one or more entities on the other side. So in a way, you have calling, the basic point-to-point calling or you know, you could have conferencing kind of a scenario. In either case, basically, the communication is between peers, and you don't have the notion of a server as such in a internet telephony kind of an application, where Skype is one of the popular ones. The other instances where peer-to-peer is used in Skype is of more interest. I mean, because you know the nature of the application is such that it is already peer-to-peer, but there are other aspects of Skype, in particular user location and communication behind NATs, which are more interesting applications of peer-to-peer technology. So for the user location, you have, so let me walk you through the architecture of Skype, and then you know I'll refer to this DHT again. So let's see how the Skype system is organized. So you have the users, which are distributed among what are called the Skype super nodes. Okay, it's a hierarchical system where you have a two-level hierarchy here. So the Skype super nodes form part of the infrastructure, and you as a user is associated with one of those super nodes. Okay, and these Skype user super nodes keep track of where the users are, okay, in a distributed way. So no one Skype super node knows about every user. But together, they could implement something like DHT to maintain where a particular user is at a given point in time. Okay, so you have scalability coming in just the physical organization of the system, where no single super node is responsible for all the users, plus in terms of user location service as well, where the information is distributed as a DHT. The other aspect which I mentioned in terms of communication behind NATs, so this requires a bit more explanation. So NAT, how many of know about NAT? What is a NAT? None of you. So you may have heard about the address space in the internet exhausting in a rapid way. This is something that's coming in the news a lot lately. And it is expected that by September of this year, the address space is going to be exhausted and we have to move to IPv6 by then. Okay. So in IPv4, which is the current IP version or the internet protocol version, we have 32 bits for addressing a host in the internet. And these addresses, because of the scarcity to start with, I mean, I think they've been allocated in ways which were not very efficient to start with, and then, you know, people started to notice that, you know, we're going to run out of that. And one of the hacks is the network address translation tables. Okay, that's called the NAT. So typically, if you have broadband at home, then you are working behind a NAT. Okay. So what happens is your ISP typically has a block of IP addresses, which it allocates in a dynamic way, like using a protocol called DHCP. And you, as a broadband user, meaning your broadband router at your home, gets one of those addresses. Okay. But you may have tens of devices at your home, or just a couple of devices, or any number of devices. But those are not visible outside in the public internet. The only thing that is visible is the public IP address that your ISP gives you. Okay, so the translation between the private addresses that are used inside your home and the public IP address that the world knows is what is called network address translation. Okay, so every time you try and communicate to the internet, so essentially there is a mapping that happens. So the source address is replaced with the public IP address, and the reverse happens when you get a response or some sort of an incoming packet. So the effect of that is two hosts which are behind NATs cannot talk to each other directly because, you know, they are using private addresses. Okay, so if you and they are not uniquely identifiable because you may have multiple devices behind each NAT, so they cannot form a connection. And this is a problem because most users are behind NATs, especially home users. And if you want to have a Skype session between, you know, two users at home, then you have to somehow get around this. And the way Skype gets around this is an interesting use of peer-to-peer ideas. So essentially what it does is, like I said, you know, previously each Skype user is associated with a supernode. So what they do is they try and recruit another supernode as a relay, which has to be non-natted, or essentially it should not be behind a NAT. Okay, so once that characteristic is satisfied, so what you could do is, as a home user, you could, as let's say one of the parties in the call, you could establish a connection to the relay, and the same thing can be done by the other party, and your session in terms of a call session can happen via the relay, because there is nothing preventing you from establishing a connection to a non-natted device. Okay, so essentially you stitch together two sessions and form one high-level call session. So that's the idea. Okay, so every time, let's name this A and the other end as B. So whenever A wants to say something to B over Skype, it essentially says this over the session via the relay, and relay, all it does is it just forwards blindly. Okay. So that's how you get around this NAT problem using peer-to-peer in Skype. Okay. So that's pretty much what I have to say about peer-to-peer applications. What we're going to do now is, we'll look at socket programming, which is sometimes referred to as network programming. So this is something which you need as an application developer if you want to use any kind of network infrastructure. Okay. So that's the plan. So sockets, like I referred to maybe a few lectures ago, essentially are interfaces for you to use the network protocols forming your infrastructure. Okay, so you could look at it as a black box where you want to talk to another host, but your visibility is only limited to just the socket. So you just send your messages into the socket and get messages out of the socket, and the rest of it you don't care. Okay, that's a good aspect of the socket API. So pictorially, you have something like this, where you have an application which is essentially a process in the host operating system, and your application may be communicating with another process at another host, and in order to do that, you go via sockets. Okay. Now, there are two types of sockets, depending on which transport layer protocol you use in the internet. One is the TCP socket, and the other is the UDP socket. So essentially, we have two transport protocols within the internet. And I referred to TCP previously already. Essentially, what it provides to applications is just reliability. Okay, from a user standpoint, it provides reliability. From a system or network standpoint, it provides other benefits like congestion control, flow control, and so forth. Okay, and the way TCP functions is, first thing, it is connection oriented, and it also is a byte stream protocol, what is called a byte stream protocol. So what that means is essentially it looks at data as a stream of bytes. Okay, there is no boundary as such in terms of packets and messages and so forth. So it just looks at it like a stream of characters. And that's basically sort of a high-level overview of what TCP is. Now, if you want to realize a client-server application using TCP, then you need to have a server which is listening on a TCP port all the time and pretty much waiting for clients to connect to it. Okay? So clients then come into the system and then establish a connection with the server, and then the server in turn creates a socket dedicated for the client that just contacted, and then they use these pair of sockets to pretty much send receive messages. Okay, so that's how things work in the TCP context. Let's look at this a bit more detail. So what you do is to start with is you have the server which has to come up before any client comes up. So assume that server is running on this particular host with the host ID, and it is using port X, which is well known to all the clients which are going to connect. So for instance, for your assignment, when you develop the client and the server sides of the application, then you need to sort of pretty much agree between your client and server programs in terms of what port you're going to use for the server. Okay, so that, let's name it X, and it all it does is it just sits on this blocking call where you have something called a welcome socket, which is a new socket created whenever you a client contacts you. Okay, so you're just waiting for a client to contact you. And this welcome socket, it accepts client connection requests, and then you get a new socket, which is what you use for actual communication with the client. Okay, so this is something which is common to all clients. So this is sort of like a parent socket, which spawns new sockets each time a client connects. So let's see what happens on the client side. You come up as a client and you create a socket, and this socket, as a part of the part of creating the socket, you specify what the host ID of the server is and what port your server process is running at. Okay. So these two pieces of information you supply to the socket. And once that is done, the socket call is itself a composition of several things. So if you give a host name, then it does this DNS resolution that we have seen before. So it's sort of done underneath for you. And the second thing it does is it tries to establish a TCP connection. There is a handshake TCP undergoes when you're trying to first start a session, and that session is also that connection establishment is also done for you. So essentially, just this call will create a TCP connection with your server, and on the server side you have the connection socket, and on the client side you have client socket. So remember that this connection socket and client socket are names that we have given here. So they are the result of doing this accept call on the server side and calling a socket function on the client side. Okay. So once this is done, all is set up. All we have is essentially a pipe, a reliable pipe, between the client and the server, and they can send data into that, take data out of that. Okay. So, but still, they need to coordinate in some form, because otherwise, if both are trying to do let's say both are waiting for data from the pipe, then you have the classical deadlock problem. So pretty much you're stuck. So this coordination is important whenever you want to achieve some high-level task. So let's say the high-level task is you send something and then you get the same thing back, like an echo message, echo application. So in that case, you send a request using the client socket, that is read on the server side, and then it just sends it back, okay? Via the same socket, and then you read that, and you close the socket, okay? So it's like a very, like a Hello World equivalent for network programming. And when you have this, so typically the closing of the socket is done only at the client side. You don't need to explicitly close the connection on the server side. Okay. So when this happens, again, TCP by specification, it has a three-way handshake to tear down a connection. So essentially, that is triggered whenever you close a client socket. Okay, client initiates that, and then you have this FIN exchanges. FIN is a message in TCP. We'll look at that in the next chapter on the transport layer. Now, that is, again, this is sort of still a high-level overview of how communication using sockets happen over TCP. Okay, let's look at some code to get a bit more concrete feel. Now, to do that, we'll use the streams in Java. The book uses Java as a language to demonstrate how socket programming can be used. In the old days, I think C was the most common language used for socket programming. But nowadays, it's mainly Java because it's very concise in terms of how you can write network programs. So we're going to use the streams. You don't need to pay too much attention to this. I'm going to look at this in the context of the example. So the example here is a slightly sophisticated example. There's nothing really fancy that you're doing. It's still like an echo, except that what the server does is it receives data from the client, and all it does is it just capitalizes whatever the client has sent and then sends it back. Okay. It's just a minor computation that you do, and then you send it back to the client. So that's what you do. Okay. Let's look at the code for this. So from the client side. So you sort of first use the packages in Java for the streams and the network. Classes like the socket. So we're going to use the socket class, and we're going to also use the, on the server side, we're going to use the server socket class. Okay. So that's sort of, and this part is fairly standard. So we define two strings, so a sentence and a modified sentence. Okay. So this is related to the example that we're going to deal with. So basically, we send a sentence and we get a modified sentence back from a client perspective. And we define a few streams. One stream is to get data from the user. So user types in data from the keyboard, and then you want to grab that. And then you define a string for that, in from user. And you create a socket, a TCP socket with host name of the server, and the port number at which it is waiting on, okay? So in return, you get a socket created, and you name it client socket. And what you want to do is you want to send what you got from the user to the server. And for that, you create a stream again, which is an output stream for on the client socket. And you define another stream, which actually, yes, pretty much, you know, this is something that I already said. So you want to create another stream that actually takes data out of the socket, okay, that you define as in from server. So basically, the server sends you something, you want to get that out of the socket. Socket is almost like a device for you, okay? At the application level, it's like a device you're writing to and reading from. And you can also visualize it as just like a file. Yeah. Now, what the user supplies is put in a sentence, and you write that to the server using the output stream, and you get back what the server sends and pretty much print that. So this is fairly trivial stuff. Okay. So, and then at the end of it, you just close the socket. And this triggers this TCP connection teardown process. Let's see what happens on the client, on the server side. So just the key thing to remember is this part. This did all the main work. Okay. Let's see how you go about doing the same things on the server side. In the server side, regardless of any particular client, you have a parent socket, which is the server socket. And then you give it a particular port number, which is well known to all your clients. And the job of this particular socket is to just sit on waiting until a client contacts. So pretty much client contacting is essentially calling that socket function on the client side, okay? So whenever that happens, so basically you're sitting in an infinite loop waiting for those requests. So basically whenever a client makes that socket call, you have this accept function unblocking for you. And the thing that you get out of this function is a new socket, which you name as connection socket for that particular client. And the rest of it is pretty much corresponding to what you have done on the client side. Now you have to read from the socket, and you have to modify that sentence and write it back. So you need two streams. So you need to read from the socket and write to the socket. So here, in from client is basically to read from the socket, and out to client is to write to the socket. And what you're doing is you're reading the client sentence from the input stream, and you're just doing some manipulation and then sending it back to the client, and that's it. Okay. So in terms of the networking part of it, all you have is these two calls. These are the two key calls. So you have a parent socket, and then you have a new socket that is created every time a client tries to connect. Okay. That's about TCP. So important thing to remember here is whenever you're trying to communicate via the socket, you don't provide the host name or the port number. Those things are pretty much implicit because you already created a pipe into which you are putting data and taking data out. Okay, so you don't specify it each time you use the pipe. Okay. Now let's see how things change when you use UDP. So UDP doesn't do anything, actually. I mean, I think basically it is a bare bones transport protocol. All it provides is process-to-process communication using ports. So it doesn't provide reliability either. It doesn't do congestion control, flow control, nothing. So this is one of the transport protocols that the internet provides. And you put whatever application requirement you have on top of UDP. So UDP, even though it doesn't do anything, it provides a very flexible foundation to sort of implement all of those things within the application. So the target of your assignment is to actually use UDP to provide reliability. So essentially, you use UDP as a foundation and then add reliability at the application layer. Okay. So in UDP terms, a UDP segment or a UDP packet is called a datagram. And this is something sometimes confused with the network layer packets. Network layer packets are also called datagrams, especially in textbooks. Okay, so but since UDP was defined ages ago, some of this terminology is still standing. So in this context, we refer to UDP packets as datagrams. Okay. So all UDP does is it communicates in terms of datagrams. So it has these packets that it wants to send to the other end. Each packet can take a different route. Some packets might get lost. They might come in a different order. All of these things could happen to packets. Okay, but basically we're dealing with datagrams or UDP packets. Now let's see what we have to do to communicate over a UDP socket. Okay, so on the server side, any server, regardless of whether it is using UDP or TCP, it has to be up and running all the time and before any client comes up. Okay, so for that we need to create a socket and listening on a well-known port. So that is common. Okay, and suppose it is running on this particular host ID. This is relevant for the other end which tries to connect to it. Now you make a call called datagram socket. This is in Java, and then you get in return a new socket created for you. And there's nothing that you provide here. So it's basically a socket that you just create locally, okay, to write to and to read back. On the client side, you also do the same thing. So previously, recall that we created a socket, but we provided the host name of the server and the port number of the server as inputs to that socket in the TCP case. Here, we just create a dummy socket. And what we do from then on is whenever we want to send a packet, a UDP packet or a datagram to the server, or server wants to send it to the client, you essentially construct a datagram including the host name and the IP address, host name and the port number of the other end explicitly in each packet. So pretty much each packet is independent on its own, and that's how you deal with communication. Okay. So you put the IP address and the port number of the server, and then you send it datagram. The server gets it and it tries to construct a reply by trying to get the IP address and port number of the client, and then constructs a datagram and then sends it back to the client. And that's how the client receives it, and then client reads it, and then it is done, it closes. And actually here you explicitly need to close the socket, because there is nothing that happens from the client side to close down the connection. There is no connection as such in the UDP case. So, or your operating system can do garbage collection by trying to sort of close sockets and release. Basically, whenever you create a socket, you are allocating some resources in terms of buffers on the operating system side, on the host operating system side. So that needs to be freed up whenever you're done with the socket. So in a sense, that can be handled for you by the operating system if you don't explicitly close the connection. Okay. So pictorially, the process seems very similar. Let's see in the context of a real program how this works. Okay. So we have a lot of similar stuff, like the streams are very similar. We're not going to change any of that. All we're going to change is we're going to create a client socket. We're dealing with Java client written in UDP, okay, for UDP. You create a client socket, and then what you do is you know which host the server is running on, and then the port number it is using. So you first do the translation explicitly, the name resolution or the DNS call explicitly here. So you take it takes the host name as the input and then provides you the corresponding IP address. Okay. Previously, it sort of happened behind the scenes through this socket call, which does so many things in terms of it does this DNS resolution, it does also the connection establishment in TCP. Here, you're doing this yourself, and then you create packets actually. So these are data portion of your packets. Okay, you create two byte arrays, send data and receive data. The send data is what you send to the server, and then receive data, you get it back. So, of course, you know, these are just named to make it easy to understand what they're doing. And then, like before, we just read a sentence from the user, and you put that content into the send data array, okay, which is your payload. Now, our next job is to construct a packet, a UDP packet or a datagram to send it to the server. And to do that, we call this datagram packet. Okay? We create a new packet, and as input to that, we provide the data that we want to put in, the length of the data, the IP address, and the port number of the server. Okay? So once you do that, you pretty much, all you need to do is you have to write to the socket that you created. And you send that packet, and you do the opposite of receiving. You create a receive packet and then get what the server is sending to you in that.